Accession with 31393, Reel 1.
John Humberton, Reel 1. John, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Yes, I was born in Czechoslovakia, which was the country called before the war. And I was born in 1921 in a very small little place called Lazy, which you would pronounce lazy, but it's called Lazy. So that's it.
And can you give me a little bit of background about your family?
I come from a mixed family. My mother was Jewish. My father was from a Christian family. But unfortunately, my father died when I was 3 years old of TB, which was quite rampant in those days. So my mother moved back to her father. And so I grew up really between the Christian and the Jewish religion. When I went to school, I was listening to the, in my country, a Roman Catholic priest. When I came home, my granddad said, "Don't listen to that rubbish, I'll tell you something else." So that was my upbringing. But my parents, I was surprised, were very wise. They left me without any religion, and they said I should choose when I'm old enough, which I have done, and I became a Christian. But unfortunately, the Nazi regime did not recognize anything like that, because the Nuremberg laws, I think, would persecute a Jew, half Jew, and a quarter Jew. They had to stop at 1/8 of a Jew because Hitler would have come into it.
So what was life like growing up?
Life for me was exciting because I always wanted to fly. And my mother said, "You wanted to fly before you learned to walk." I was crazy. I was making model aeroplanes and, cut a long story short, I was in, you know, always playing with aircraft and making models and neglecting my studies. But I did manage as a student to learn to glide. And I belonged to a club which was a unique club in Czechoslovakia. But of course, that was at the age of 16, 17. And yes, life was very nice, until it was interrupted by the Nazi regime in 1938-39.
You're interested in aviation. You said it was before...
I was always mad about aeroplanes. I remember, I think it was in 1927, the airship Italia, which flew over my little village to the North Pole with the captain, I think Nobile was his name. They did make it, but I think they had to be rescued. I was crazy. I was running after aeroplanes when they flew over. I was trying to get to the nearest possible military aerodrome, which was about 40 miles away, and I stood there for hours just watching. Always crazy.
And what did you make your model aircraft out of?
In those days, they didn't have any kits. They were just ordinary bits of wood, I think, which you use to make sausages, long narrow sticks with cotton and a bit of glue and I think parchment paper. And of course, you know, I flew them, and I didn't have any design. I just made them freehand. I didn't have any models or any paper to design, and I just didn't know anything about the center of gravity. If they didn't fly well, I put a bit of weight on the front and so on.
Did you follow the exploits of the kind of famous aviators of the 1920s?
Oh, yes, I did. I was always interested in people. But in those days, there were a lot of flights to the North Pole, I think. And, of course, the read a story about Blériot flying the Channel, and then the... I knew about Amelia Earhart and people like that. And I remember about Hughes going around the world in a Lockheed Electra, if I can remember rightly, in 3 days and something. So I was crazy. Anything to do with flying, anything.
Can you tell me about how you came to learn to glide?
Well, there was a club called a Flying League. As a student, you could join, and it was sponsored by the state, I think, with the idea that it might produce future pilots for the Czech Air Force. So anybody who was interested could join it, and I did. It was just basic, you know, I don't know what you call that model, but it was one of those where you sit on a seat with nothing around you, just the wings. And you made little hops from the hill, and you flew down, I should think, half a mile. That's about all.
And did that still encourage you with your love of flying, though?
That made me really very encouraged. And, of course, my hopes were dampened by the political situation, because my idea was to finish my studies, get my matriculation, and then join the Czech Air Force. But that was, of course, stopped due to the political disruption by Nazi Germany.
So how aware were you of that approaching situation prior to the Nazis? How were you aware of the situation?
Oh, I was very much aware of the situation because my family was extremely politically minded. I listened to Hitler's speech when he came to power. I followed the popularity of Hitler, which I could understand in those days because Germany, in my opinion, after the Versailles Treaty, was punished too severely, which gave a chance to Hitler to rise to power. And I always had the feeling that the French were our allies, because in the First World War we had a huge they call them legions in the First World War, who fought with the French. And so I always felt that France would come and help us. And oddly enough, I always believed that the Slavonic nation of Russia would come and help us. I knew very little about Stalin. I never compared Stalin to Hitler. Anybody who was opposed to Hitler was my ally. So I was very much aware of the situation.
And how do things manifest, obviously, at the time of...
Well, it manifests itself by the fact that the Munich crisis gave the Sudetenland to Hitler. It was, in my opinion, a totally crazy idea at the Versailles Treaty to incorporate 3 million of Germans into a new state called Czechoslovakia. I mean, how can you expect the 3 million Germans who were really German nationality suddenly find themselves in a new state, Czechoslovakia? So it was due to cause trouble, and it did cause trouble. Hitler wanted them back in his Reich, and the Munich, unfortunately, the Munich Treaty is a very black mark in our history because the all clear has been given. And once that happened, my country had no defense lines, which were in the mountains, and I had at that time a cousin already living in England, and she telephoned and said, it's time to get out, because if you don't, it'll be too late. I mean, the occupation of Sudetenland was in September 1938, and the invasion of the rest of the country was 15th of March 1939, very short time. I got out on the 5th of August 1939, 28 days before the outbreak of the war.
So when the Germans invaded the rest of Czechoslovakia, what were you doing at that time?
I was at college. I was still studying. I was trying to finish my studies. But as it happened in March, we finished the school year, and I managed to get a visa through my cousin, a 6 month visa to the United Kingdom. But I had to get an exit permit. And, you know, when a country is occupied by a foreign power, it takes a bit of time before they get all their new laws into order. So I was still able to get a passport, which said Protectorate Bohemia and Moravia, no longer Czechoslovakia. And I had to get an exit permit, which was only granted by the Gestapo. So I stood in a queue in August, beginning of August, when I had my visa stamped in the passport from the British Embassy, where I went about 2 days. And a bit of a miracle happened there, because when my turn came, there were two Germans behind the desk. One was the German from the German Reich, who could not speak Czech, but the other one was a Sudeten German who could speak a little bit of Czech and German. I could speak German extremely well. I was bilingual from the age of 6, I think. And the first question, they said, yes, what do you want? And I said, I would like a permit to go to England. For how long? I said, well, whatever you allow me, it's school holidays. Why do you want to go? And I said, I want to learn English. And then the Reichs-German said to me, are you a Jew? And I was told before I went for the interview that I must tell them the truth, otherwise I might never come out. Before I could answer that question, the Sudeten German looked over the shoulder of his friend at my passport and he said, with a name like that, he can't be a Jew because it's my father's name. He stamped it and I went out. And I got on the train the next day because the rules were changing all the time. So in fact, my father's name, which was Nechas, which definitely not sounding a Jewish name, my mother's maiden name was Fine, which was definitely a Jewish name. It really saved my life. And I was told, if you got the exit permit, get a ticket and get going. So I did.
In that kind of 6-month period, prior to your leaving, how had the kind of occupation manifested itself?
Well, the occupation wasn't as there wasn't any cruelty or anything. It was quite normal, you know. The new Deutschmark, Reichsmark came in. German troops came in. Our army had to surrender all the weapons, which I witnessed in the town where I studied. They had to bring all the rifles on a heap in the main square. It was to do with propaganda. Children were allowed to crawl into German tanks without any shoes, and then on the film propaganda in Germany, they were told that the Czech children didn't have any shoes. That was all to do with Mr. Goebbels. No, it wasn't too bad, but I do remember that the rules were being tightened gradually. After the first month, or the first 2 months, not much was happening. But then new rules were issued and people were not allowed to travel, and people had to have passes and that kind of a thing. So it was gradual. I think it took nearly a year before they actually tightened up everything. Because my family, which was Jewish, of course, my mother was living there, they ran a village shop. And there were no restrictions or anything. There were no restrictions that they couldn't possibly travel on public transport. So that came after I left. I only learned about it after the war.
I take it, though, there was an awareness amongst your family.
My family was fully aware of what was going to happen, because we heard about the Kristallnacht, about Kristallnacht. But we always felt, I remember listening to the radio, that the Jewish question will be dealt with by the puppet Czech government of the Protectorate Bohemia Moravia very fairly and very leniently. And so my family was convinced that what was happening in Germany would not be happening over there. So that's why they were probably reluctant not to do anything about it. But my cousin, who was in England, who had the different news from a different angle, she said, if you really want to have a future, you have to get out. And she really secured the visa for me to come.
Where did you get your ticket to?
I bought a ticket to, it was Vlissingen, which is probably Hook of Holland, as we call it. A direct line from Prague to Vlissingen and then to Harwich, arriving at Liverpool Street Station. The amazing part was that when I got in the compartment, or in the carriage which was destined for Vlissingen, you could get into that and you didn't have to change. There was a German officer there. There was nobody else except me and the German officer. He started to talk to me after the train started, and he realized immediately that I was very interested in aviation, and he showed me some photographs of new aircraft, and he was coming from Prague, converting the Avia factory to some manufacturing of German aircraft. And cut a long story short, I traveled with him, to him right up to Osnabrück, and he even said, would you like to come to dinner? There's a two-hour stop in some place. I was scared, so I didn't want to go, so I made apologies. But before we parted, he said, well, if you go into England for 14 days and you're so keen in flying, here is my visit card. When you come back, if you call it our flying school, we might teach you to fly. I thought, oh, yes. He didn't know much about me, my background, but he was extremely polite. And I must say, when the border control came over to check my passport, you could never really tell whether these guys were in a good mood. Even if my papers were in order, you never know whether they're going to turn you back. As soon as I opened the door, he told them to disappear. He said, you know, he was a high-ranking officer. So they left me, so no problem. But when I crossed the Dutch border, there was such a jubilation and such celebration going on. I thought, God, what's happened? The war started, and they told me, no, the Queen had another baby. It was one of those princesses born. And I arrived at Harwich, and from Harwich on a train to Liverpool Street Station, and my cousin, who was still in England, collected me and found me a job in a garage in Selsdon, near Croydon.
So was that what the plans were for you at that time?
Yes, there were the plans, yes, to get out while it was possible. Because once the war started, that was it. You've heard of the so-called the kinder transport, the children transport. Well, they stopped, and as I came on the 5th of August, and I think the last transport left, I think, on the 24th of August, and then that was stopped.
So it wasn't long after you arrived that Germany invaded Poland?
Yes, the war started here on the 3rd of September, but they invaded Poland on the 1st. The war was declared, of course, by Mr. Chamberlain. I remember the sirens. And very, very shortly, I think it was just a few months or two, 3 months before Christmas, I went to the recruiting office in Croydon. They took my particulars and they said, well, as you are a foreign national, we have to contact the Czech embassy. And through that system, eventually I was called up to join, I think it went at the Uxbridge place.
So you'd gone to join the RAF?
Yes, I joined the RAF, you know, I thought I could fly a Spitfire and win the war in 14 days. Well, that was my opening to flying, and also I thought, well, I do want to do something to liberate my country and to defeat Hitler. So I thought, I don't want to be conscripted into the army, or certainly not the navy. We haven't got a navy. So I wanted to go into the RAF, yes.
And you were called up to Uxbridge?
Yeah, Uxbridge was my fitting out station. That was where you get fitted out and get your number and so on. So you were only there about 14 days, if that, you know. And from Uxbridge, I was then posted to the Czech depot, which was at RAF Cosford. And I was there only a short time. And my knowledge of English was fairly good, so they registered me as an interpreter as well. And from there, I was posted to RAF Jesperi No. 2 Signal School.
At that stage with the Czech depot, because I assume that a lot of the Czechs at that stage...
A lot of the Czechs came from the defeated from France. From France, yes. So when France was collapsing, all the people who ran away from Czechoslovakia obviously ran to France, fought with the French Air Force. When France collapsed, they nearly all managed to get back to England and joined the RAF and formed four squadrons.
So prior to that, at the stage when you were volunteering, I imagine there were a relatively small number of Czechs.
Actually, when I volunteered into the Royal Air Force. I had virtually nothing to do with the Czech Air Force. I had a different number. It was only later in the war that the Czech Air Ministry said we would like to incorporate him into our ranks. So there were very few people like me who were in England before the war who joined the Air Force, and they became actually a member of the Royal Air Force. Later, much later, I became a member of the Czech Air Force within the Royal Air Force.
So, after your introduction to RAF life, your role as an interpreter, how did that work?
Well, that was a sideline. I was interrogating prisoners of war or people who were shot down, pilots who were shot down, tried to do that kind of integration. I was called to the war office to meet some guys they captured somewhere, I don't know, in Syria or somewhere, where they were shipping, I think, material to, later on that was in the war, to Russia, I think. It was a secondary job. It had me another 3 and 6 a week, I think.
What type of things when you were interrogating a prisoner were you asking them about?
Well, it was, I was always told to make them comfortable, to be friendly. I spoke the language. One of the guys from Adornia 217 was shot down off Coltishall. He was in the sick ward at Coltishall. So the intelligence officer, some wing commander, said, "Would you like to go and talk to him? I can't speak the language. He's got a slightly cracked leg, but he's all right." So I went in there in my uniform and greeted him in German, and he was very surprised. He said to me, "Do you speak very good German?" And I said to him, "Actually, I'm not English, I'm Czech." And he went a little bit pale. But I got him in a friendly mood. And the idea was to find out where he came from. And so I sat with him, had a cup of coffee, and we talked. And he said, "Where do you come from?" I said, "From Brno, which is Brin." He said, "Oh, I go there on holiday because there's no bombing and everything like that." And so I took my map from my flying book, a map which covered part of Holland, the North Sea, and vast part of East Anglia, put it on the bed. He said, "Do you know where you are?" "Oh, yes, I know roughly where I am." And he said, we put his two fingers. He said, "So you're from Nijmegen?" And I said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Well, I shouldn't have done that." I said, "Well, that's all right, I don't mind." He said, you're near Norwich. "You're all right, you're safe." And then he told me about the rest of the crew, which didn't get saved. So the jobs like that, it was quite amusing.
And how was your training going at the signal school? What were you involved in doing that?
Well, they were using me to be trained as a wireless operator and using me as an interpreter to help the 80 boys who couldn't speak the language. So I was doing two jobs at the same time. And I didn't really want to be a wireless operator, air gunner. I wanted to be a pilot or something. But the Czech Air Ministry said, "Look, if you can help us with the 80, we need them for Bomber Command, you can then choose where you want to go afterwards." So that's what happened. I did the course with them. We were posted from there to RAF Kranovo, which was number one signal school. And there I saw for the first time a bullfighter, which crash-landed on the land, or belly-landed. And I kept asking people, I said, "Oh, they're using them as night fighters," and I got really interested in that.
With your wireless training, what did that entail? What were the things that you were having to learn at that
time? Well, Morse, of course, to operate the radio sets and the normal thing didn't incorporate any radar at that time. It was purely for wireless operators in Bomber Command. So I think all they were doing, they were using me as an interpreter and getting the training, which I never really put into practice in my flying because I didn't need it.
The majority of the men who were with you, had they all been pre-war Czech Air Force?
Not all, no. Some of them have, and some of them have just escaped to fight, and they were actually in the army, in the Czech army in France, but when they came here, they needed people for the Air Force, so they were put into the RAF. I remember they had to swear the allegiance to the British monarch, and none of them could speak, so I had to do it on mass in English, and they had to repeat after me. That was crazy, anyhow. There was 84, 85 people there. And so I think the whole course of wireless operator was really a course to have an interpreter there, I think.
You said you'd moved on to Cranwell.
Yes, I moved to Cranwell, where the 80 people finished their training, and they were posted to a air gunnery school. I don't quite know where, but I think they were on ferry battles or defiance, I'm not sure. And I was posted to the Czech Air Ministry in London, or the Czech Air Protectorate, Air Inspectorate, which was part of the Air Ministry. And there I could put my foot down and said, I want to go and fly something I want to fly. So they said, we've got enough pilots, but we need night fighters. And there was a pilot who was on arrest because he was shot down in the Defiant. He was looking for a navigator. And he said, would you like to come with me to form a crew? I said, are we in fighter command? Because I want to be in fighter command. I said, yes. And this is how it started. We're posted to RAF High Air Corps near Shrewsbury.
Had you done any navigational training at that stage?
No, no. I was one of those guys, believe it or not, due to time and pressure, who was actually destined to be trained on the squadron. They had a squadron flight, sea flight, and I was flying Blenheim's Mark IV with radar. It's the first time I was introduced to airborne radar, AI, air interception. And instead of being posted to a school, which in those days was very, very limited and not really developed, they needed people very quickly because night fighting up to then was done in moonlight by Spitfires and Hurricanes, without any radar on board. It was purely a matter of good luck. And they realized that if they want to combat the blitz and the bombing, they need something more efficient. So I was trained on the squadron at High Air Corps, started on a Blenheim and then on a Bowfighter with my pilot together.
Your pilot, where was he from?
He was Czech. He was from Czechoslovakia, but he was a regular officer before the war. He was in the Air Force already before the war. And he picked me. He was there on an arrest, and so we went back to the squadron. And the commanding officer was Max Etkin, son of Lord Beaverbrook. And so I remember after about 2 months, less than 2 months, flying practice interceptions, you know, and doing navigation, radar navigation by a youth radar. He called me into the office. Because of my name, Nature, as they call it, Nickers and Nicky. They said, Nicky, are you fit for ops? Of course, your answer was always yes. He said, okay, you're on ops tonight. You're on the roster. And this is how it started.